Hey everybody, welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today's August 16th.
Whoa!
This is some Russian pop music from the 1980s. Links in the show notes. Anyway, today on the show, this is a live appearance that I did last Saturday on a new LRN show called ALP. That is an acronym that changes weekly. The week that I was on last Saturday, it stood for Accelerated Learning Program. I like that. I'm a big fan of the host of this show, Allie. She is a talented young Liberty Media personality. I also got to know her co-host a little bit, Ellen. She was great. And they had me on the show because they wanted to discuss the Iron Curtain and maybe in the broader scope, the Cold War. And I was very honored to be their first guest. There was a lot that I wanted to get to in this conversation. Unfortunately, time just didn't allow it. So, you know, this is a topic I might explore more in the future. I'm real into Russians lately. I don't know why. I've got one of those brides on the way. I'm listening to Russian 80s music. It's getting serious. So anyway, folks, there's more stuff in the queue. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This week, I came up with something new that stood for, are you curious?
I haven't even told you, Ellen. I know. I'm excited.
This week, ALP stands for Accelerated Learning Program.
Yes.
Because I was in my Accelerated Learning Program for most of high school, yet I learned almost nothing. In all my years of high school, well, I guess it was only four, I took all the advanced learning classes. And I even took an advanced history class, and I totally just got left in the dust. I didn't really understand anything about, I failed like almost every test just because it was, read these pages in the textbook, and it was just so outlandishly boring. And by the way, listeners, you can watch the show and even chat with listeners if you go to lrn.fm, if you're listening to the archive of the show. And also, go to facebook.com/ALP podcast and give us a like, because my goal for the show was to have 100 likes by episode 4. We're already at, I think, 94. So
that's pretty good.
Yeah, that was a reasonable goal I set, which I didn't realize. I set it when we were at like 75, and it's been steadily going up. We got the initial, that initial 75 was within like the between episode 1 and 2. So it kind of plateaued since then. And so getting the word out, sharing it with your friends, that'll help us a lot. And we're already on episode 3, and we already have a guest. And he is Brett Vinat from School Sucks Project. Go to schoolsucksproject.com. And Brett is our first guest. And it's really exciting to have him on because, since I know nothing about history, and we're doing our first show on something that I feel kind of vulnerable about, because we're talking about the Iron Curtain today, and this is something that people throw around for historical context. Oh, the Iron Curtain and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and I don't really know what they're talking about because I never really studied this in depth, but I feel like I should, because I feel like it ties into the ideas of individualism versus collectivism. And so we have Brett Vinat on. Hey, Brett.
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
So good to have you on. And I know you just from like Pork Fest and everything. I don't know if you've met Ellen, have you?
No, I've never met him before.
Ellen, we did actually meet briefly.
Did we?
At Porkfest, yeah.
Oh, you meet so many people at Porkfest. How can you remember? You probably didn't realize what a big
deal
that was.
I'm embarrassed now. No, I didn't.
Don't. Well, Brett actually had his, if I understand correctly, it's been 4 years since you started School Sucks?
Yeah, I started it in August of 2009. So we just reached our 4 year mark and we've done 240 shows, maybe.
Wow, congratulations.
Thank you.
So when you started School Sucks, it was even before then, you were wanting to be a history teacher. Am I understanding that correctly?
I was wanting to be, yeah. I actually had a plan at one time that I was going to be a history teacher in a public school, and just a chain of events in between like 2002 and 2005, I actually wound up teaching history in a private school, and no one was paying very, very close attention to what I was doing, so I could get away with exploring a lot of controversial topics.
Were the students paying attention?
It was a mixed group. Some were really into it. And unfortunately, I was getting them kind of at the end of the whole schooling process. So I think that a lot of them, and I don't fault them for this, they just kind of sorted me into the category of here's another boring teacher and here's another boring history class. Because history has, I mean, aside from like grades 1 through 3, where we learn this wonderful, warm mythology about the history of the country, after that we're pretty much just like filling out worksheets and remembering dates. So most
right.
people kind of walk away from the whole public school history experience is that there's this magical story about the origins, and then the rest of it's kind of boring, so I'm not going to look into it anymore. And you know, some students were really engaged and others didn't care. But, it was definitely a learning experience for me. Teaching is a great way to learn.
So history isn't just all about remembering the names of certain dictators and presidents and learning dates and stuff like that, because I am terrible with that kind of thing. Like, I can't remember I can barely remember my birthday. If that gives you any sense of how bad I am at history.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I did not pay attention to history at all in school, but I'm only now finding it interesting.
Oh, it's very interesting. And yeah, it's really more about ideas. And depending on what kind of time and energy and enthusiasm you have, you can certainly always probe deeper. And you'll find that your memory and your mind does start to form new helpful habits for, you know, remembering names and remembering dates and making connections. And there's certainly, you know, a multitude of tools that you can use to help with that. But for most of us, yeah, I mean, dates are not terribly important. And, history is really about ideas.
Well, I wonder why then so many history teachers, like the ones that were responsible for teaching me. I mean, ultimately, I'm responsible for teaching myself, which is why the show is so exciting, is because it's about self-education. And I wanted it to be that for other people as well as myself. But I didn't really ever take that on in school because I was so bogged down with all the homework assignments. And mm-hmm. they really made me resent history, honestly. It made me sort of like, it seemed like mythology the way you described it. I think makes really describes it well, because it always seemed like it was really biased, and that the history book never went in depth into the things that I might have found super interesting. And when it came to like war and things like that, they would always just talk about strategy between the different countries and things like that that influenced the war. And I was just never really that interested in that. I wasn't interested in the military or anything in that regard. So they didn't touch on the part of the story which engaged me. And since high school, I have looked into certain things, usually to try to make my points about liberty or why we need more freedom make more sense to people, because people love to bring up history to try to defeat your points. Like, they'll say, well, the war is what brought us out of the Great Depression and things like that. It really requires going back and looking at different opinions on that to be able to address people who say these things.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah, it seems like the way history is presented in school, it's basically just a chronology of presidential administrations. So the visibility of real people is just way overlooked in making history. And even when there are these revolutionary forces in history, you don't really get the sense that the people had any efficacy or power in making those things happen. So if you learn about the example that I use on the show frequently is the civil rights movement. If you were learning about that through a government school textbook, your assessment would be that, you know, one day this lone woman, this hero that you can't be because she was special. Her name was Rosa Parks. She mustered the courage to sit in the wrong place in the bus. Then this other guy, another hero that you can't be, named Martin Luther King, you know, came along and gave some speeches. And then this white guy from Texas named Lyndon Johnson signed some papers and the government gave black people their rights.
Right.
You know, and obviously I'm being very oversimplifying. But, you know, you only walk away with the broad strokes. And that's what the broad strokes are from that story. But that's really the story of, you know, people and courage, and that's
right.
Almost entirely omitted.
The stories that you get in the average public school textbook are very disempowering. I think that's part of why I wasn't really that interested in history in school. But we're going to talk more about this in the Iron Curtain after the break.
I think that Stalingrad was changed to St. Petersburg.
Okay. All right, we'll come back on it. Resentment for most of my public school teachers who I feel like failed me, but finally now I'm taking responsibility for my own education, and the Iron Curtain is definitely something that I don't know a lot about. And so I wanted to sort of, before we started researching this at all, I was sort of confused when people refer to Iron Curtain. Are they talking about I sort of picture an actual wall? When you look at maps, they like draw it like a physical wall they put up. But then I thought, no, there's no way the communists could afford that. So,
well, as far as I have seen, there was actually fences built like all along this border. Like the Berlin Wall, which is the most famous one, was actually a wall.
And yeah, I've definitely seen pictures of that.
Yeah, in most places in Europe, there was actually like two fences, like two chain link fences with barbed wire on the top, and there was like a no man's land in between. So for most of it, it was actually like a physical barrier, but it was also an ideological barrier in the sense that they were trying to keep the Western ideologies out.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem like it was definitely in the propaganda, they played up the ideological differences between the East and the West. But, Brett, was it like something where if I was on the east side, there was no escape into the West?
Well, the wall was built very quickly in 1961, and there were armed guards supervising the construction. And apparently their orders were to shoot anyone who tried to defect. Because, I mean, that's, you know, one of the features of a closed communist society is that if people understand that it's a closed communist society because Western information or non-communist information penetrates into that society, people will try to escape. Now, that happens very rarely in some places where they have things locked down pretty tightly, like in North Korea, and people think that the leadership there are basically gods. But that wasn't the case. I mean, East Berlin or East Germany generally was very close to the West, which really symbolized, whether it actually stood for them or not, you know, the ideas of freedom and capitalism. And people, you know, certainly understood the difficulties of life being under essentially in the Eastern Bloc Eastern Europe under Soviet rule. And many people did want to escape that. Sure.
Well, people always hype this up as, well, look, we had this scientific experiment where on one side we had freedom and the other side we had tyranny. And look which side did better. And I think that there is definitely seems like there's truth in that argument. And I'm basing that off of seeing, like, just pictures in Berlin, you know, on the eastern side. It looks destitute and just run down and scary and very militarized. And the other side, it looks like somewhere you could raise your kids. And so I think that there's truth in that. But when it comes to, like, the Cold War and the propaganda, it seems like both sides, there was, like, misbehavior on both sides. There was anti-freedom rhetoric coming from both sides, wouldn't you say?
Oh, sure. And you know, there's different perspectives on different sides of the wall. In East Berlin and, again, East Germany and the Eastern Bloc generally, I mean, their story is that it's basically a barrier to protect against fascism encroaching from the West. That, you know, these forces from Europe and Great Britain and the United States wanted to come in and stop the will of the people to have freedom.
So, but wasn't the Soviet view fascism?
Well, they're certainly both authoritarianism and collectivism and totalitarianism. But yeah, I mean, that political spectrum where you have supposedly at one extreme communism, at the other extreme fascism, that's not real. It bends back and you have, authoritarianism. So they're similar in that respect. But the communist propaganda always talks about capitalism as fascism. And there are some shreds of truth in that, because what they're defining as capitalism is not really capitalism. But they saw, you know, the forces of the West, specifically at this time, the United States and Great Britain, as an encroaching force on, you know, this people's movement of communism. So that rhetoric was very heavy, that the wall was protecting the people of East Berlin and East Germany from Western fascism. Now, here's the other part of that, too. And this probably brings it closest to home for the people in East Germany. Berlin, 5 years prior to the Cold War, was under Nazi control, and that was definitely fascist. So they're stirring up these fears in the people in the Eastern Bloc that, hey, is West Germany, like, really free of Nazism, or are there some hangers-on? And, right. And you know, Nazism, or certainly a lot of the academics and intellectuals that moved Nazism forward were still lingering in Europe, in the United States, after the end of World War II. So there are shreds of truth in this communist propaganda.
Well, it's interesting because I was looking into Marxist theory, I guess, and they don't really seem like they're that interested. Like, they realize that they need capital in the first place in order to carry out Marxism, because you have to have something to spread around. But it doesn't seem like they are very interested in everyone. It's not, the theory doesn't go that, oh, well, eventually we all, like, gain a better standard of living and we all become better off over time. It just sort of seems like we'll all just be happy getting what we need, and that should be enough. And the West, they can have their extra stuff. They can have their televisions and their phones and all these things, but it's not, but look at the cost of it. You have fascism and you get these companies which get huge and take over everything. So did it seem like people who were maybe sympathetic to the communist side of things, like, making that trade-off, they were claiming that maybe they won't be as well off in their day-to-day lives, but perhaps it'll be better than having this fascist government?
I think in many respects, yeah, they viewed the West as decadent, and capitalism as greed and recklessness. The only exception I would make is that they did understand in these communist countries the value of television once it became available for mass distribution.
They used that to their advantage.
Yeah, and you were mentioning, like, the difference in appearance between East and West Berlin. I mean, you can look at satellite photos of the Korean Peninsula at night, and North Korea is completely dark, and South Korea is lit up like Las Vegas.
Ooh. Hey, guys, welcome back to ALP, the Accelerated Learning Program. We're talking about picking back up on our conversation about the Iron Curtain. And right before the break, unfortunately, the break cut off Brett in the middle of his point. But we're talking about how the communists were using TV to their advantage. That I said something about how maybe that they were sort of giving up the decadence of the West and their television. But no, apparently they were definitely taking advantage of television in the East. So can you tell us a little bit about that, Brett? Was it like a propagating tool?
Yeah. In North Korea today, there's a television in every room in people's houses. And they're certainly not, 46-inch flat screens. They're probably these old dusty wood-paneled tube TVs from the 70s. And they only get one channel, and that channel is state television. But certainly, as communists and collectivists and have recognized the power of state education, state media, or at least state-controlled or even state-influenced media, as we see in the West, has proven to be a very effective tool for, shaping public opinion.
Well,
so
right.
TV is definitely encouraged.
There was propaganda on both sides, and almost like identical propaganda from both sides. It was like the same guy was like, here you go, East, here you go, West. This is what you tell your people when it comes to this issue.
From what I've seen, like the West like rejected the East ideology, or the East rejected the West ideology. I mean, the Soviets, they were saying the West was evil and just stick with traditional values. But I'm not exactly sure, like, what exactly was the West trying to keep the East out of for?
Sure. Do you know the answer to that, Brett?
Well, I think that, we are talking about the Iron Curtain as this idea that's really simply just embodied by the Berlin Wall, and that, from the West perspective, this separates good and evil. And I guess from the East perspective, they have similar propaganda. But the Iron Curtain is not representative of some great philosophical divide, because even by the time the actual physical wall was put up in the 1960s, the most important debates, so there's all of this dichotomy between the East and the West, but the most important debates had long been settled. And most people, whether they were in the USSR or the United States, they didn't even know that those debates had taken place.
Well, yeah, what do you mean by the debates been settled? Like people, like logical people who were looking into the superiority of individualism versus collectivism had sort of come to agree, but I mean, most people aren't really, I guess most people feel like they don't have time to look into these kind of debates. They're just trying to go to work and make a living.
Right. Most people didn't even know that these debates had taken place, or really that there was no debate and it had been decided, because collectivism is more efficient than individualism. Authoritarianism is more efficient than libertarianism. So I would say that we should think of the Iron Curtain not as this actual black line on a map, but more like the border of a time zone, right? So, as we were in the West, and in the 1950s and the 1960s, there are many places in the West that are comparatively free when you look at the Eastern Bloc, the Eastern European countries, or Russia or China. And I say it like a time zone because the world turns, and the world has turned. So at that point of time, the further you went to the East, the later you got in the game. You had Eastern Europe, which was bad, Russia and China, which were worse. And I think, there were maybe 60 million deaths total in the Soviet Union and maybe like 45 million in communist China. But as you shift further west, you see that things seem to get freer as you go through Western Europe into the UK and ultimately into the United States. But like I said, the world has turned. So, you introduced this topic to me a few days ago with this Billy Joel video. And it seems like the story that I gathered was Billy Joel gets really upset. It's just like a 45-second clip where he tips over his piano and smashes a microphone stand because he's mad that he's performing in Moscow in the 80s and somebody is shining a light through the audience. Stop lighting the audience. Why does it always seem to hit me in the middle of the night? Stop it. Maybe there's a number I can always dial. Let me do my show, for Christ's sake. Just a fantasy. Oh, it's not working. Oh, And there's maybe some misunderstanding, but he's worried that it's the KGB. And when people in the crowd see a light shining on them, they are they're not having a good time at a concert anymore.
Right.
Right.
They're frightened by that because they feel like they can only have a good time in private, maybe.
Yeah, I thought that the light shining on the crowd was like the Stasi spying on people to see if they're having too much fun. And to see who was, like, a questionable character or whatever. And you brought up to me before the show, like, maybe it wasn't them. Maybe it was just the crew documenting this.
Yeah, I'm not sure who exactly was shining the lights, but I think the reaction of people, my understanding is that people were just, like, sitting, basically, when they had the light shining on them, that they were sort of, like, straightened up. It's sort of like when you're in class and the teacher leaves and you're all being really casual and having a fun time, and then the teacher walks in and you immediately shut up and sit down. It's probably a lot like that.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, though, like, how much psychological stress were these people under?
Well, that's the thing, too, because that seems like you have some American patriot telling you this story, and they say it was so bad under communism, obviously it was so bad under communism, but this just seems so foreign that people are paralyzed by fear by having the light shined on them. And America isn't like that, but that was the world of the 1980s, where in Eastern Europe and Soviet Russia, people gathered in large crowds and were occasionally granted permission to watch other people do what they like to do, to watch other people live their purpose, and they could watch and applaud. But today in America, most people are living their lives online, especially considering some of the developments we've seen lately. They should have the same concerns. Now, I'm not encouraging anyone to be paralyzed by fear, like what seems to show up in the crowd of that Billy Joel video.
Well, but I am to some degree. Like, I'm pretty careful about the things I say online, even to the extent that I'm worried that certain things could be taken out of context. Like, I might say something and then I'm like, well, if someone saw this who didn't know what I meant by it, they could totally try to make it seem like I'm a violent person, maybe. And so I just won't even say it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, while it's not healthy to live in fear, there is sort of a healthy anxiety about, that just leads to people being careful. Because I think what people are feeling in the crowd in Moscow, or whether that was Moscow or East Germany or any of those places under Soviet rule, what they're feeling is, okay, somebody is watching me. Are they going to do with they collect? What's the chain of custody?
And yeah, they feel like there's consequences coming behind this. And I want to talk more about what are the consequences be for having a good time at a concert, for instance, on the other side of the wall. There goes the cam. If you're watching on LRN.FM, and you can see the webcam we have here. It is positioned on Ellen, and it just went flying across the room because I'm very clumsy. So we are talking about the Iron Curtain, and we have really just sort of been talking about how what it would be like, what would be different about between the East and the West, and what life would be like between those two places. And the thing is that I've always known that war is a racket in the sense that someone's profiting from all this destruction, and because otherwise it wouldn't happen, right? Pretty much every war is somehow to someone's benefit, and usually that name doesn't come out when we hear the news talking about how we're going to invade this other country. But when it comes to Cold War, there's the military might get hyped up and everything, but they're not actually destroying their bombs and they're not using their tanks. So it's sort of a racket in a different way. So Brett was actually telling me during the break a little bit about the way in which this standoff was actually sort of a racket in the way that you might not expect. Can you go into that, Brett?
Sure. Well, I think that's what's important to understand first is that socialism is always sold to people right up to the present day as like a wealth redistribution program. It's not. It's a wealth consolidation and control program. And, you know, all throughout the 20th century, or at least since the Russian Revolution in the 19-teens, there have been networks of people who are positioned to benefit from that. Now, certainly the costs are high, right? Because these people, while they might consider themselves, you know, capitalists, they don't have any moral guidance. So in these societies, as these collectivist communist societies grow, obviously, power is shifted away from the individual. Now, that leads to a widespread perceived helplessness that allows a lot of these horrors that we see in communist China and, you know, the gulag forced labor camps in Russia and even other types of collectivism, like what you had with hypernationalism in Nazi Germany. All of those horrors become possible if, you know, individuals are taught that they're dependent on the state and they're completely helpless.
Well, is it better to have like a bunch of disenfranchised sort of like feeling hopeless masses of people? Or is it better to have a bunch of people who are really strongly behind the government and feel like the government really benefits them a lot? Because I feel like there's a difference between the person's like, you know, like I see in the United States, the difference between someone who is really on the government's side when it comes to every issue and very nationalistic versus someone who realizes that maybe they're not in favor of what the government does, but they feel helpless to do anything about it.
Well, I think one also kind of leads to the other, because if people don't feel like they, you know, have a lot of self-efficacy or self-confidence in making these kinds of important decisions, that leads to a helplessness, which can lead to a dependence on the government, even if it's a reluctant dependence. You know, the same way we see a lot of people who kind of slug their way through some shitty job that they hate, but they do it because they need the, you know, what else am I going to do? I need the health insurance. I need the benefits. And, you know, these are governments that were providing a lot of so-called benefits to the people. So it almost becomes easier to not look at maybe some of the problems, because, you know, facing the problems or facing the violation of humanity that goes on in a lot of these societies, if people look at that stuff and they have, you know, some conscience, which almost all people do, if they see enough of the horror, they're going to be compelled to act.
So it's almost like a rational ignorance, because like, why worry about something that you have no control over? Right.
Right. Right. So in America, you can watch reality TV. In North Korea, you can go to some kind of weird circus in some soccer stadium that was built in the 1950s where everybody's participating in the show. But it's distraction. I mean, this goes back to at least the Roman Empire. You know, they said, give the people bread and circuses, keep them entertained and fed, and they won't pay attention to what you're really doing.
Well, but while I was researching for this, I read this article written by a woman who said that she grew up around the Iron Curtain, like right next to the Berlin Wall. She visited it when she was younger, and, you know, in school she always thought that, you know, she should probably go against the government. But while she was growing up, she realized, you know, it wasn't all bad, because unemployment was low and homelessness, the rates were low, and you know, everybody had a job, everybody had food, everybody had a place to stay. She knew it wasn't all bad, but like at the same time, she could sense that she was being like caged in. So do you think that was like a widespread idea that people had? Like they realized that they were caged in, but they accepted it because, you know,
they had
a better lifestyle.
Well, I really think that kind of runs against the human spirit, to feel like you're a cog in somebody else's machine, to feel like you are a human resource. So I think that over time, even if you have some very basic comfort, some stale bread that you only have to wait in line an hour and a half to get on a good day. So, yeah, I'm fed, and yeah, I work at this factory making, you know, something for some shitty car that you can penetrate the outside of with a sharp pencil. But when you talk about this article that you read, it reminded me years ago, I listened to this podcast and it was like walking tours through cities. And they did one, a walking tour through East Berlin. And they interviewed this woman. Her name was Nadia Dre. She was born in Leipzig, Germany in 1977. That's the year I was born. So I'm thinking, here's a girl my age, and she's going to describe this completely alien world. And I heard this probably like 2006, 2007 and didn't think much of it at the time. So I actually went on iTunes and I found it and I'm like, all right, well, with this new perspective, how am I going to react to what she describes? This is what she said. My dad told me, tell me when this starts to sound familiar. Don't talk to the police. They're just trying to come up with some reason to arrest you. You're being spied on. So act accordingly. Barter when you can, right? Because of all the government controls over commerce, that there's a lot of inefficiency. So when you can just, you know, barter behind the scenes,
right,
outside of government controls, do that.
Well, I'm curious about like what kind of underground economies would have started, because like anytime you try to control people, they may not outwardly resist. They might secretly resist for self-preservation. So I feel like there must have been some kind of underground black market economy going on, even in the East. It seems like it would be, maybe it's something that was kept so secret that a lot of people don't necessarily still know about it, but there have to be remnants of that.
I don't know. It depends on where you're talking about, because most of the Eastern Bloc, and certainly Russia, is under control of the KGB. The East German secret police, I think Ellen mentioned, were called the Stasi. They were very, very scary. And
why were they so scary?
Well, it was really kind of a crapshoot as to what was going to happen to you. You were really not so much at the whim of the individual officers, but they had interesting policing tactics. Like in the Gestapo,
right,
in Nazi Germany, they really relied on snitching. They would expect people to come to them with information or send them anonymous letters.
See something, say something.
Yeah, see something, say something. But the communism is all about quotas. So Murray Rothbard gives this great example in For New Liberty when he's talking about, you know, Soviet production, that they were only given quotas for and he might have been simplifying a little, but they were only given quotas for the number of shoes that a factory had to turn out. So they could save leather if they made all small shoes.
Right.
So factories would meet their quota and then there'd be shoe shortages for adults. So the Stasi, And I'm thinking most KGB run organizations, policing organizations in Eastern Europe, they use quotas. At the end of every period, whether it's a week or a month or a quarter, they have to have a certain number of arrests. And obviously they answer, the officers in the Stasi answer to people even scarier than they are. So there's stories at some points when they're not looking like they're going to hit their quotas, especially in East Germany. There was a time when there was this real strong anti-Polish sentiment. The officers would go through phone books and just look for Polish names go arrest those people.
Right. I know that in Poland they had a major like anti-Polish movement. Like they sent so many Polish people to concentration camps. And also like the quotas, you know, they don't lead to efficiency. They only lead to people trying to find crimes within normal human activity.
You know, I'm sure that Brett might realize this, but it's like giving me chills how much of what he's talking about, the tactics and everything of the government, how much that relates to the government here. It's very concerning.
We have so much to say about that.
We will get more into that when we come back. You're listening to ALP. Empowerment and enlightenment. Go on over to facebook.com/ALP podcast. Guess what, Ellen? We have
what?
96 likes. Four
yes.
more likes and we reach my goal.
We're so close.
We're so close. So go on over there and like ALP on Facebook. And you can always send us an email at ALPgirls@gmail.com. And of course, you can listen to the show live on LRN.FM. We are joined here tonight. Our first guest ever is with us is Brett Vinette. Vinat, I'm sorry.
The way you said it the first time.
Well, I was calling you Brett Vinette for like a long time and correcting people when they said Brett Vinette. I was like, no, it's Vinette. And because I just thought, you know, whatever, how could I forget a name like Brett Vinette? It rhymes. And then you were actually on Puke in the Gang. And I had told my boyfriend, who's on that show, it's Brett Bennett. And then I was embarrassed when I was wrong. But Puke in the Gang is a nothing show.
I think I like your way better.
You should change it. Tell us where people can find more on School Sucks Project.
Sure. Well, our main website is schoolsucksproject.com, and I encourage people to go there and register and participate in our forums, and you can post your own content and chat with other users, and you can join groups. So if you have a specific interest under the umbrella of education, like homeschooling, there's a group there for that. You can go and join it. You can, you know, contact me if you want to start a new group. We have a Twitter, School Sucks Show, a Facebook page that you can like. If you just search Facebook for School Sucks Podcast, you'll find us. We have a YouTube channel. Our username is School Sucks Podcast, and we do a lot of stuff there that doesn't appear in the regular podcast feed. And I'll also just say this. If people, you know, go and check us out and listen to a few shows or watch a few videos and they like what we do and they think this is something worth supporting, we also have something called the AV Club, which for $6 a month, you help the show not just continue, but continue to grow. And you get access to, I think, like 300 additional pieces of content that has not been released publicly anywhere. A lot of videos, a lot of audio stuff, a lot of behind the scenes.
Wow.
So if people think that School Sucks is worth supporting, if this is a message worth projecting, I encourage them to do that as well.
Wow. When are you going to start your own college?
Oh, good idea. We are in some talks about starting some kind of educational institution.
Hopefully tuition isn't too high because I would like to attend.
Oh.
I never went to college, but I would definitely go to the School Sucks Project College. That seems
I'm going to give you one of those honorary PhDs that they give to politicians.
That would be awesome. I could run for president like my childhood dreams. So we're talking about the Iron Curtain. It's leading to all kinds of interesting discussion and sort of relating it back to current day. I'm really interested in how it, like a lot of what we're talking about with the Soviets, is so related to what's happening in the United States now.
So I know another way of the psychological warfare or what have you they used was through the Stasi. They actually used like psychological warfare, like they would freak people out, like rearrange their houses or replace like one specific type of tea with a different kind, just to make people think that they were being watched, just to keep them in line. So was that a popular way of, you know, keeping people loyal to the East?
At least keeping people uneasy and afraid. And psychological warfare is one of the least talked about but most important aspects of you know, the modern state. And there are psychological warfare campaigns going on in the United States at the same time and right up to the present day. So, I think that can really have an impact, really a disorienting impact, when people can't develop that clarity and ultimately, you know, a direction or some kind of idea of how they should act. They're just living in fear. You know, they're very easy to control.
Yeah, fear is definitely a big controlling factor within societies. I know, like, today, there's a lot of people that are paranoid of, like, saying anything online or doing anything out in public, lest they be considered a terrorist. So was there something like that similar in Russia? Like, were you considered a terrorist if you said, like, people should have basic human dignities or something like that?
I would say, you know, you would certainly face some kind of police action, possibly arrest. I mean, if we want to go into the Soviet Union under Stalin, we have the Gulag system of forced labor camps. One of the most famous residents, unfortunately, there's just tens of millions of people who were sucked into these gulags who we don't know anything about. But there was a Russian novelist named Alexander Solzhenitsyn who wrote this very famous work called The Gulag Archipelago, where he recounts his experience in a Stalinist forced labor camp. But, I mean, he was arrested, I think, in the late 40s, early 50s, because he wrote a letter to his friend criticizing some of Stalin's policies. And it was interrupted by, or intercepted rather, by some kind of mail control service. And he was found and he was arrested as a dissident, basically for, what we call in the United States today, espionage.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah, I mean, all governments need some kind of boogeyman in order to keep people under control because no one wants to be the boogeyman. We'll be right back.
Welcome back. You are listening to ALP, and our subject for the night is the Iron Curtain. So we're here with Brett, and Brett, I just wanted to ask, you said something earlier about the U.S. funding the Soviets, and I just wanted to know, like, what was that all about? What was the U.S. funding for?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I would love to discuss that, and I think I can kind of lead into that, picking up on something that Ali said right before the break, where she talked about this boogeyman. And, you know, whether you're talking about government power or, as you just hinted at, the people who attach themselves to that coercive power, whether they be bankers or Wall Street financiers, war, conflict, international tension, perceived external threats, i.e. the boogeyman, that's a great time to get things done. Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State under Nixon and involved in a myriad of other things in and around the government, paraphrasing, but one time he said, you know, in 5 years of war, we can accomplish what it takes 20 years of peace to get done. Because when there's that panic, when there's that fear, when there's that tension, nobody is asking questions. You know, the stimulus and response, otherwise you see something and you react, stimulus and response are very close.
Is that why the Cold War went on for so long?
Well, I think it's part of it, because there was that fear, especially when we're talking about mutually assured destruction, where the two countries had, you know, nuclear arsenals that could wipe each other out. There's this quote that I heard a couple of years ago. It was actually from this Jewish psychologist who was a Holocaust survivor. His name was Viktor Frankl, and it immediately became one of my favorite quotes. And it is, "Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response, and in our response lies our growth and our freedom." So when you can get people to, you give them some kind of stimulus and they have a programmed reaction, there is no space, which means there is no power, which means there is no freedom. So war is an incredibly effective tool of social control. And, you know, there's a long story that goes into the funding of the communists that I'll get to in a minute. But there's an interesting, and remember, too, that we're not just talking about Wall Street and central or international banking. America, the government, is allied with the Soviet Union until the end of World War II.
That's right, because their common enemy being Germany, right?
Right. So one of the great dividing points or escalations of the Cold War is something called the Marshall Plan, which is a plan for basically European economic reconstruction.
And this was chosen over the Morgenthau Plan, right?
I believe so, yeah. But again, this is one of the things that you look a little deeper and you find there never really was any real debate about it. But the Marshall Plan is really how the U.S. takes the first global position. And Churchill knew, and the people in the shadows who are also running the U.K., they knew that when the United States became involved in World War II on the side of the Allies and the Soviets, that the Brits were essentially ceding global primacy to the United States, that we can't do this anymore. We need you to come in. And there's a story that goes with that. But I mean, essentially what we see with the Marshall Plan is that these Wall Street types, these international bankers, have just continued throughout the 20th century, right up through the Iraq War, basically view and use the world as their own personal casino, where they're just essentially endlessly being comped by U.S. taxpayers. In other words, the taxpayers foot the bill. That's who paid for the Marshall Plan, and they can reap the rewards.
See, what do you mean exactly by that? Because I know the Marshall Plan was a plan to fund European countries that were against basically the Soviets. So what do you mean, like, it was a sort of, like, gambling rig?
Well, it's like gambling where you can always win because you're gambling with other people's money. I mean, this is essentially a bailout of Western European economies after World War II. The bill is paid by U.S. taxpayers. If those markets can open back up, if there can be a resurgence in those Western European economies, well, who's going to benefit? The people who can build factories there, the people who are in shipping, the people who are in banking, the people who are in the oil business. So they stand to gain. The American taxpayers pay. Now, there are probably collectivist arguments that can be formulated that, well, if Western democratic Europe does well, that's good for the world and good for the United States and good for the people. But there are real direct beneficiaries of a European economic recovery.
Well, what kind of stuff was the money going towards? Just towards the war efforts?
Well, I mean, think about it in modern terms. You see all these companies like Halliburton and Bechtel that after something is destroyed, say in a war like Iraq, they get to go in and rebuild everything.
Oh, the window repairmen.
The window repairman, right. Yeah. Fallacy of the broken window. And another thing that's very profitable is war. But war ends due to the exhaustion of human resources. But you can't have peace because that doesn't pay the bills. Like Smedley Butler, the famous Marine, wrote that book in the 1930s, War is a Racket. And he explained how he was basically a hitman in a uniform for all of these U.S. corporations and banks that had attached themselves to government power. So let's not confuse that with capitalism. You know, that's cronyism. That's corporatism. That's basically socialism for corporations. So this huge bailout of all these European economies in America, it's criticized from both sides of the political spectrum, from the left and the right. And on the right, they're saying this is basically like trying to take Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal and project it out to the world. And their criticisms are well-founded. And on the left, they're saying, you know, well, this is just a projection of American imperial power. And they're right, too. So the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, they have this big conference around this time. And, you know, they're saying that, you know, a couple quotes from this meeting that they have in Poland in the late 1940s. International politics is dominated by a ruling clique of American imperialists. They call it the enslavement of the weakened capitalist countries of Europe. So they're basically seeing this as a capitalist, as they would call it, but basically this corporatist takeover of a devastated Western Europe after the war.
I wonder who these people are and if they have names, but we'll have to wait until after the break to find out. You're listening to ALP. With our guest, Brett Vinat. Thank you so much for being on our show, Brett. This is super interesting stuff.
Good. I'm glad. And I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me as your first guest.
I know. What a privilege, right? So we actually have been getting into some almost conspiracy-sounding stuff. And maybe this will turn some people off. But if it's, you know, this stuff is things, these are things you can trace back and you can look at. It's not like you have to go to this YouTube channel and hit the spot in the video to find out. These are things that have been documented. And I'm looking at the Wikipedia page on Anthony Sutton, and is kind of really creepy stuff. And I'm curious, you know, is this like a name? When we talk about people who profit from war. I'm wondering, like, are we ever going to know who these people are? Are they hiding, or are they out in the open? Are they people that we can actually point to and say, hey, this guy is making a lot of money off this war?
Sure. A lot of their names are still on buildings all over the United States. But there's a lot to that story, and this is a vast network, so I'll try to simplify it the best I can. I think the most important thing to understand, and something that would probably, you know, to speak a language that the libertarians are comfortable with, you know, we understand the dangers of power. And at the top level, there's really no difference between the communists and the so-called capitalists, because they're unified by power lust. And they're recognizing, I think, especially when we're talking about the Wall Street types, they're recognizing something that a lot of libertarians recognize, that national sovereignty or nationalism are silly made-up ideas, and that borders are imaginary lines. So eventually they want to try to establish monopolies beyond the borders of the United States. And this is kind of like, where would this power lust come from? But with power, whether it comes from money or government, over time, I think a narcissism develops. And with that narcissism comes the importance of legacy. Mm-hmm. And whether we're talking about the British nationalists feel like they have a legacy, they have a duty to project British culture out into the world, the same way the Nazis talked about, like, we owe it to the rest of Europe to spread our perfect enlightened culture to the surrounding nations. The same way today the United States says, you know, we are the last best hope for freedom and democracy in the world. And we have to, you know, even if it has to come out of exploding bombs, we have to deliver it to these countries in the Middle East. So, you know, from The Godfather Part Two to Game of Thrones, you have these, you know, power drunken people saying, birth me a son, you know, the name must continue, that kind of thing.
Right.
So that's really prevalent, whether we're talking about, you know, cultural traditions like with the British, or these family traditions, these names that just have gone on and on and continue to be at the pinnacle of power, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Rothschilds, these all pretty much deal with banking and industry.
Well, even like families where I think everyone is familiar with, like, families where someone will get super wealthy on an idea, and usually they do that by benefiting the masses, you know, selling their product. The masses are like, thank you, gimme, gimme. And then the guy gets super wealthy, and he gets wealthy to a certain point where it's obviously not just for him anymore or her. You know, they have enough money to live very well for the rest of their lives. It's for their kids, and they want to continue the legacy. So, like, it doesn't really surprise me when you've got a whole nation, or just like this huge span of people, multiple nations of people who are susceptible to being ruled in this way, that there's this huge power grab. Like, who can blame, you know, who's surprised that anyone comes and says, sign me up for that, because, you know, there's money to be made on this.
Yeah, sure. And I don't want to demonize wealth or even, you know, healthy greed in any way. And, you know, by all means, you know, if you have something that will make you into a millionaire or a billionaire, I highly recommend it. I'm rooting for you, you know. So I don't want to sound like I'm demonizing wealth or rich people generally.
Sure.
There's a formula that's very dangerous. Money plus access to government equals a new kind of power, a kind of power that I think a lot of libertarians and voluntarists don't completely understand. So I recommend the work of Anthony Sutton, who in 1973 actually wrote a book called What is Libertarianism, which was a new word to the public at that time. But the other books that he was writing around that time, to get back to some of the funding connections, were far more interesting and I think serve our purposes better. Sutton is an academic. He's a professor, and then he's a research fellow at something called the Hoover Institute, which is part of Stanford University. In the late 60s and early 70s, he writes this three-volume set of very technical academic books called Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development, covering the period from about 1917, which is the Russian Revolution, to 1965. Now, during this time, he realizes how much Western resources, whether we're talking about the government or private resources, are being funneled into communist Russia. So his next book, which is basically a consolidation of that three-volume set, it's pretty self-explanatory. It's called National Suicide, Military Aid to the Soviet Union. From there,
that's
Sutton
a title.
Gives, yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I think we get what he's saying. Like, you know, we're supposed to be locked in this, not only this ideological struggle, but also this potentially world ending military conflict with these two nuclear powers. We're sending them aid. We're sending them technology to build ballistic missiles, you know, because it's first of all, it's profitable. And we've heard this story before, kind of just in abstractions of like, oh, we're selling our enemies weapons so they have weapons. And then the government can say, well, look at these weapons they have. We need to, you know, increase our military budgets.
Yeah.
It's very much what in simple terms, that's very much what Sutton is dealing with. But he continues to dig deeper because these are some startling revelations.
Well, it's very questionable.
I looked him up on Wikipedia and I just found this, you know, quote from him. There's no such thing as Soviet technology. Almost all, perhaps 90 to 95%, came directly or indirectly from the United States and its allies. In effect, the United States and the NATO countries have built the Soviet Union, its industrial and its military capabilities. This massive construction job has taken 50 years since the revolution in 1917. It has been carried out through the trade and sale of plants, equipment, and technical assistance.
So does this say basically that the U.S. funded, like, the Soviet arms race, like, that was all funded by the U.S.?
They're enablers.
There's examples where, and when we're talking about the U.S., we're talking about Western interests that are attached to government power, not necessarily, even though I'm not exempting the U.S. government from providing U.S. taxpayer aid to the Soviet Union during the Cold War. But Lenin, when he comes to power around 1923, starts developing these five-year plans, like in 5 years, we'll be here. After 5 years, we'll be here.
That sounds familiar.
And what Sutton is saying is that every Russian industry was restarted after World War I, which was pretty devastating, and the Russian Revolution, which was very bloody. Every Russian industry virtually was restarted by foreign corporations. And he names them: General Electric, DuPont, Ford built automotive plants in the Soviet Union. There's one plant built with American money that's 36 square miles, I learned today. And the real danger is that if you have a plant that can make something like cars, well, to make up a word, it's also weaponizable. In other words, that plant can be dual purpose.
Right.
You know, it can be used to make military hardware as well. If you can make a Ford car there, there's all kinds of military hardware that could be produced there as well.
It's very scary because I would hate to see the United States economy used for, you know, all our industry being used for war purposes. I would never want to see that happen. I'm being a little sarcastic. We'll be right back. Isn't that a weird visual image? It's like a monkey. Okay, we're going back, Colin. Facebook.com/ALP podcast. We're here with Brett Vanat from SchoolSucksProject.com, and we're talking about the Iron Curtain and Soviet Russia. I was asking Ellen during the break if she's got any Russian in her, because she looks a little Russian to me.
Maybe no, I'm not Russian at all, actually.
Maybe people watching the cam can confirm if, am I just crazy?
I know Russians. I'm not Russian.
All I'm saying is don't try to control me.
Exactly. I mean, even if I was Russian, like, does that mean that I'm a Stasi supporter?
Obviously. So Brett's telling us about this Anthony Sutton character. I had never heard of him until today, and I feel like I maybe should have, because he had a lot of important things to say that maybe if you looked into, you might be seen as some kind of crazy conspiracy theorist by your friends. Mm-hmm. But then you can just show them the Wikipedia page and maybe they'll still try to discredit that. But I'm sure there's other sources, right, Brett? Like, could you show them something else?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if as you go on and you see that after he comes to these revelations about, I mean, and Sutton was basically blackballed by academia. There are other sources that are saying the same thing. Carol Quigley's book, Tragedy and Hope. Carol Quigley is writing about a lot of these networks from the inside, you know, from some of these very secretive roundtable groups that originated in Britain in the 19th century to the Council on Foreign Relations. And he's an insider. He's saying, look, this is great. We should tell people that we're doing this. Why so secret? But Sutton is more of an outsider and an investigator, and it's through this work that he does on Western technology and Soviet economic development that his research goes further. So after he writes National Suicide, the title of his next three books, first one is called Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution. The second one is called Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler. And the third one is called Wall Street and FDR, meaning Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So basically he's saying that these financiers are playing all sides against the middle, essentially. And that makes sense, you know, to cover your bases like that. But there's a quote in the first book, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, that I wanted to share because I think it ties things together nicely. Sutton writes, "It may be observed that both the extreme right and extreme left of the conventional political spectrum are absolutely collectivist. The National Socialist, for example, the Fascist, and the International Socialist, for example, the Communist, both recommend totalitarian politico-economic systems based on naked, unfettered political power and individual coercion. Both systems require monopoly control of society. While monopoly control of industries was once the objective of J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller, by the late 19th century, the inner sanctums of Wall Street understood that the most efficient way to gain an unchallenged monopoly was to go political and make society go to work for the monopolists under the name of the public good and the public interest. Therefore, an alternative conceptual packaging of political ideas and politico-economic systems would be that of ranking the degree of individual freedom versus the degree of centralized political control. Under such an ordering, the corporate welfare state and socialism are at the same end of the spectrum. Hence, we sense that monopoly control of society can have different labels while owning common features."
Well, it kind of makes me think of like Obamacare or something like that, where, you know, you put sick people out there as your reason for wanting to collectivize when it comes to paying for everyone's health care. And that, yeah, I mean, someone's getting rich off of that.
Right. And this is why we still see when we go outside the United States, not just talking about how domestic corporations benefit from new government programs and new laws, but why does the U.S. have this record of supporting dictatorships in the Middle East, in Central America, in Guatemala? Because there's fewer palms to grease. You know, when control is highly centralized, you don't have to establish a consensus among the population. You have basically a dictator puppet. And you know, Saddam Hussein was that for a while. They set that up in Iran under the Shah to suck oil out of that country for BP. So, you know, this is not a unique model. This has been replicated in a variety of locations and states throughout the 20th century. What's right. interesting.
Oh, go ahead, sorry. Ellen, go sorry. Ahead. Oh, OK. What I was going to say was that it's really interesting because you can see that, like, exactly what you said, word for word, played out in the U.S. right now. And, you know, I was just wondering, like, I see a correlation kind of between today's cops and law enforcement and the Stasis of the Soviet Union. And I was just wondering, like, what...
The empire depends on them.
Yeah, exactly. So, like, what kind of connections do you see between those two?
Well, I think that that's the great irony of this whole story, is that while all of these Western resources and technology, like right down to the technology for missile guidance systems, are pouring in from the United States into communist Russia, it seems like there's this exportation of ideas from the communist collectivist Eastern world to the West. So during the Red Scare, you know, Americans are looking everywhere for this subversion, except in the right places. And that was basically international banking and academia, that collectivism was infiltrating and subverting the ideology of the United States. And if we look at the world that we live in today, you know, there's this meme on Facebook that's been really popular over the last year. It shows some terrible picture of some police state thing. And it says, meanwhile, in East Germany. And then below that, it says, oh, wait, that's America. Collectivism, go back to what I said earlier, in that great debate that never happened between collectivism and individualism, collectivism won. With that comes all of these horrors, because it means the empowerment of the state and basically the demolition of the individual.
Well, we're definitely not taught in history class that collectivism won, but it seems like it should send red flags off in people's minds when they hear the story that you're given in public schools, and then they see things like Edward Snowden is having to hide in Russia from the United States trying to prosecute him for basically giving information to journalists.
Well, you know, that's not something that most people see, because, like, I've asked everyone that I've worked with and even everyone else that I've encountered, and none of them seem to know anything about the Iron Curtain or, you know, the Soviets or the Cold War. Like, it's not something that people are taught, really. It's not something that they remember. It's not like people know that, like, during the Cold War, there was, like, one Stasi spy for every 167 people or whatever. Like, nobody seems to know that. And it seems
like, well, based
like,
on this conversation and what you just said, I could see why we're not told about this.
Yeah, and it just seems like there's a large correlation between today's society and the society of the Soviets.
Sure, and when people lack the historical context, they can't see that, right? So people accept things at face value. We also have this problem with authoritarianism or just obedience generally. You know, the media is an authority. The government is an authority. And even though people might talk about, well, I don't trust politicians or I don't trust CNN, they're absorbing those messages without question, and they lack the historical context. I mean, the reason why the U.S. is so open, it's so out in the open about cronyism and, you know, this corporatism in the rebuilding of Iraq is because the roots of this are so deep that there's nothing that anybody, they don't think there's anything anyone can do about it.
Yes, as far as in people's minds, the story started when the World Trade Centers fell, and that's the only thing they know. And they have no context, and I myself don't even know the whole story behind all the U.S. involvement in the Middle East. But, you know, I just know from people like Ron Paul sort of going into a little bit that there is a history there, and maybe it's not as one-sided as it's being portrayed.
Yeah, people don't even know that the U.S. actually funded the beginnings of the Al-Qaeda movement.
Oh, sure. That would actually, if we had more time, tie back to the story we were just talking about.
Well, we're going to have you on again to talk more about this stuff, because this is super interesting. And thank you for reviving my interest in history, Brett. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime you need a third person, let me know. This was great fun.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Everyone, go to schoolsucksproject.com to hear more from Brett. He's got like 4 years of content there, so you'll never run out. Thanks for being on, Brett.
Thank you guys so much.
You've been listening to ALP. Catch us on Facebook and like our page. We need 100 likes before the next episode.
Woo!